upset about things and attack, attack, attack. Jack Layton campaigned nice, perhaps not the most vicious attack dog, but nonetheless was aggressive in the House of Commons. Mulcair, who is not obviously not a leadership contender, and a lot of NDPers have problems with where he led the party, was nonetheless a very effective parliamentarian in terms of the fact that he led the assault against Stephen Harper in the latter years and essentially opened up the door to Justin Trudeau's win in 2015. If they find a street fighter like that, ideally someone with a bit more working class cred, ideally someone who communicates much more effectively with all communities and regions across the country, I think they would have a very good chance of getting back into, you know, the same position they were just, you know, less than a decade ago, of either being the opposition party or being a strong third place contender.
Who would that street fighter be? Charlie Angus comes to mind, but he's retired and he, like all scoundrels, is now a podcaster. Who in the ranks? I mean, a lot of people are just like staying clear of this. Like, a lot of people are like very decidedly not getting in the ring. David Eby, Wob Kanu, Olivia Chow, probably wise. Montreal Mayor Valerie Plante. All these people have said, not me. In terms of who we know wants to lead the NDP, you've got Edmonton Strathcona MP Heather McPherson, one of the seven surviving NDPers holding it down in the House of Commons. Here's what she sounds like.
We need to have a leader in place so that we are ready when the next election comes to put our case forward to Canadians, to make Canadians understand how important it is that there are new Democrats that are sitting around the table, that are pushing the government, that are holding whatever the government of the day is accountable for the promises they make to Canadians.
And we've got Avi Lewis, who ran for federal office twice unsuccessfully. He's also the co-author of the LEAP Manifesto, the Environmental Manifesto. He's got the bona fides. He's Stephen Lewis's son and Naomi Klein's partner, and he's worked in journalism. Here's what he sounds like.
There is legitimate rage about the way that the NDP has been run over the last couple of decades, and a need for, I think, a transformation of the culture and practices of the party. I think the election results in many ways were an assertion of a desire for us to have a different political and social system, and I think that means we need a different economic system, and that's the big change that needs to be made.
So far, those are the two front runners. They have not made public announcements yet, but the Toronto Star reports that they have put their names forward internally. So, Taylor, choose your street fighter.
I mean, look, you're obviously forcing me to do this. You've put a gun to my head, so now I have to make a choice. I would say that at the very least, Avi Lewis could be a very effective fighter on the environment. And if he can make the argument that climate change is not fundamentally a question of the environment, but more specifically is a looming economic apocalypse that Canada is absolutely not prepared for and needs to address under the strictest economic terms, if he can make that argument and fight like hell to get this country off of its addiction to fossil fuels, then we might have someone, a real fighter, who could potentially hold the government to account for their consistent flip-flopping on environmental issues, as well as provide an alternative to Pierre Poilievre's proto-petro-fascism.
I don't know if Avi Lewis can credibly put himself forward as an expert on economics. I do know that he's never won an election. I guess my bigger question is, there is a playbook here in terms of how the left might get its mojo back and connect with people. And we're seeing it play out in the United States. We're seeing massive audiences show up for Bernie Sanders and AOC. We're seeing a flank of the Democratic Party suggesting a possible path to popular support. It's what you say. It's reclaiming a status as the representative of working people. I don't know anybody in Canada. I mean, we had Jagmeet in here. I think he was trying to get on that action. He was trying to make directly those connections and associate himself with those figures. And he sat here in the studio where I'm speaking to you from. And just, I know that there is a dialogue about his failures that has to do with the fact that maybe there was some element of racism and people's inability to relate to him as a working person. Like, there's still this conception of the working person in Canada as a white working person. Maybe there was some latent racism in that. But on a person-to-person level, he seemed like a smart and nice guy who just was detached from reality and was not listening to people and was not connecting with people. And all of the talk about his prowess on TikTok, he did not occupy that space that those American figures did of just speaking plainly to people about economic issues and class. He was never able to get there.
I think I'm biased somewhat because I'm from Quebec, and I know people who attended Singh rallies in Quebec and just saw him get completely shellacked by like the worst racists you've ever met in your entire life and kind of just had to stand there and grin and take it. I would not underplay that because I think that did play a very significant role. It's curious to me that it seems like the best moment Jagmeet had in Canadian politics was when he turned on that heckler and confronted the heckler and called the heckler a coward.
What did you say something?
What?
Did I say something?
Did you say nothing?
Who was it that?
Was it you?
No.
You sure?
If it was me, I'd admit it, buddy.
Was it you or not?
If it was me, I'd admit it.
My word. You sure it's not you?
No.
100%.
You're a coward. You're not going to say it to my face. That's what's thought.
Everybody for like a week was like, Jagmeet, yes. I mean, let's be honest, most of us wanted to see him turn around and pop that guy and tell him what's what. I wouldn't have criticized him for it, whether it's becoming of a prime minister or not. I don't really care.
But he did better than that. He was strong without resorting to violence. And that was, I think, I agree, that was his best moment because that's when he seemed to be about something.
So just to get back to one issue that you brought up before, this, I am not confident that the... I'm misusing this term, but the cults of personality that have developed with certain star candidates on the left wing of the Democratic Party, I don't personally think has been that effective because it hasn't translated into real victories. Now, there's a certain amount of underhandedness that goes on in the United States. We know that Bernie Sanders was undercut by the DNC, who, among other things, highlighted the fact that he was Jewish to like Southern voters to dissuade them from voting for him. We're seeing the same thing with New York City mayoral candidate Zohran Mamdani, who, you know, Cuomo is ready to like hitch his wagon to Trump of all people in an effort to potentially derail the Mamdani campaign, which I think is very unfortunate.
Let's hear Mamdani for a second, because I think this does give you a little bit of a sense of what is connecting with people right now.
Working people are being pushed out of the city they built. A mayor could change this, and that's why I'm running. Life in this city doesn't need to be this hard, but politicians like Eric Adams and Andrew Cuomo want it to be this way. They care about their donors. They care about themselves. They don't care about you.
We've shown that by focusing on the issues of working and middle-class New Yorkers across this city, that by listening instead of lecturing, that by creating a politics of no translation, New Yorkers will join you in your fight for a new city.
That's good talent. And that smart use of language there. What did you say, listening and not lecturing?
Yeah.
That is its own kind of dog whistle. Like, that is a recognition that people feel that they've been lectured at by the left, and that's got to end. That we're not here to tell you how to be a good person. We're here to represent you and your economic interests. Again, it's just something that feels like, oh, we don't have anybody like that here.
There aren't too many politicians who are able to effectively communicate that they are listening to the people. There's a medium is the message problem with that. You know, Jagmeet being really great on TikTok. Great. TikTok is going out. It's not coming back in. There was essentially no campaigning of Jagmeet, the great listener. He's not a great orator, but he could have been the great listener, the guy who was out there listening to people's concerns. I don't know who is going to lead the NDP, but if I could provide them with a certain amount of unsolicited advice, it would be to, number one, not focus specifically on one figurehead leader of the party, especially as they're trying to rebuild. They need to deputize all of the potential big names within the party, get them out to various regions, get them out to various demographic groups, and the message of we're listening, we understand why life sucks right now and why you don't have an optimistic view of the future. They need to centralize that message, but deputize the people who are getting that message out there to certainly more than one. There's a problem consistent in politics almost across the board, irrespective of the level of the politics or which part of the Western liberal democratic tradition you're in, is that it's all being centralized to a single individual who, I guess, on the one hand, can take responsibility. I mean, they never do, but could theoretically take responsibility for the problems that society is having. But it's always coming out through a single mouth. And I think if the NDP is looking to rebuild, they need to get more than one mouth repeating the same message.
Well, that speaks to the need for them to embrace the listening part of that Mamdani message. The not lecturing part is another piece of that. And just look at this list of the requirements just to be a candidate to lead the NDP. So first of all, you need $100,000, which might be a little bit too high for the grassroots. But look at these finicky rules here. A leadership candidate must collect at least 500 signatures each. No more than 50% of the signatures can come from non-transgender men. At least 100 signatures collected by each candidate must come from people in equity-seeking groups, LGBTQ+, Indigenous or racialized, or those who live with a disability. At least 10% of a candidate's signatures must come from young New Democrats, 25 years or younger. Candidates must also collect at least 50 signatures apiece from each of the five different regions in Canada. Each candidate must pluck four hairs from David Suzuki's beard without him noticing, journey to the summit of Mount Logan and weave them into the nest of a golden falcon. I only made up the last one there. Everything else, I get what they're going for. I support it all in theory. It feels a bit lectury. And I think if you're trying to get away from that sense of like we're telling people what's good and how they should be, as opposed to we're trying to represent you, maybe this kind of like rules of entry is sending the wrong message.
I hear your point and disagree, and here's why. That's never going to resonate with the general public. It's too in the weeds. It's too inside baseball. And quite frankly, considering the concerns that were raised about NDP leadership sidelining a lot of the non-white segment of the party, whether at the provincial level in recent years or at the federal level, this is an attempt to deal with that problem. We don't want, and I'm saying this as a cis white male, we don't need more of me, right? In any kind of politics. I'm saying that and as someone who has considered having a political career at one point or running for office, I know that we need less of me. I don't have any problem with people like me being forced to go out and get the support of people who are not like them at all. Because if they can resonate with people who are not like them, they will be able to do that on the bigger national scale. I don't think these requirements are going to resonate. And I think a potential measure of whether or not it resonates with the general public is how many op-eds the National Post will publish on this subject. I haven't seen any yet. I might be wrong, but if the National Post isn't digging its teeth into a particular issue, then it's probably not going to have any traction.
All right, stick around because after the break, we will discuss one fringe candidate contender for NDP leadership who I think would result in just dozens and dozens of National Post editorials. Hold on, Taylor. You may have spoken too soon. I'm seeing a National Post piece here. Quote, the NDP leadership is underway and the party is limiting signatures from cis men. It was only a matter of time. But still, I think it feeds into this feeling of a battle over where is this party going to go? Now that the Liberals have moved to the right with Carney, you've got the breach writing that the NDP establishment is trying to push out more radical left members. The breach feeling that the party should move to the further radical left. And then you've got Globe and Mail's Konrad Jakubowski saying the NDP is facing a financial crisis. They do not need radical flamethrowers playing with matches. I think probably one of the candidates that might be considered a radical flamethrower is one Eve Engler. Here is activist and candidate for leadership of the NDP, Eve Engler, approaching a group of Jewish students on McGill campus, just days after the October 7th massacre. The students were not demonstrating in support of Israel. They were asking for the hostages to be returned. He approached them, and here's how that went down.
Bring them home. I'd like to offer another chant. Kill more Palestinian children. Kill more Palestinian children. Kill more Palestinian children. Kill more Palestinian. Don't touch me.
Yeah, that guy wants to run the NDP, and whereas most pro-Palestine activists are very quick to say, we are not against Jews, we are fighting against Israel or Zionists or what have you, Eve Engler wrote a piece for Mondo Weiss saying, no, in fact, the Jewish community in Toronto is who we should be going after. The Jewish community in Toronto should be a target. This, I think, is by definition a racist argument. Avi Lewis, he has been just consistently dismissive of Jewish concerns about safety in this period where there's been more anti-Jewish hatred and violence than ever before. Early on, he said, well, I don't feel unsafe, when other Jews were saying that they feel unsafe. He goes, well, I don't feel unsafe. The only people who make me feel unsafe, he argued, were other Jews who are trying to shut him up or Israel makes him feel unsafe. Then later, he gave this interview where he makes specific, I would almost say mocking references to Selena Robinson, his NDP colleague, who felt that the party was anti-Semitic, or to Jewish students who feel unsafe. to be fair to the guy, I think a lot of the things he said were, you know, before there have been quite so many beatings and stabbings and firebombings as there have now been, but he has not amended those statements in any way. Heather McPherson, some people have problems with what she's been saying, but as far as I can see, she said a lot of very outspoken things about Israel's behavior. It has not turned against Canadian Jews. I think that though this is kind of a settled science, like whoever the next leader is, they're going to probably take a much, much more strident position against Israel than Jagmeet Singh ever did. And that was a frustration of a lot of people in the NDP, that Jagmeet didn't go far enough. I think that's probably what the NDP wants and its supporters want. I wonder to what extent that gets in the way of the strategy that you were pointing to earlier, which is that this party has to capture labor, inclusive of labor that is pro-Palestine, but beyond that as well.
So a couple of things. First of all, I'm saying the next part as cynically as possible. And I don't mean to, but if you're asking me to look at a situation as objectively and politically as possible, I truly believe that the Palestinian solidarity ship has sailed in a purely political sense, because I suspect that over the course of the next year, the leader of every party in Canada is going to distance themselves and their parties from previous unequivocal support of the state of Israel to more nuanced positions. And I think we're going to see this across the board. I would hope that the NDP would be smart enough to distinguish between criticism of something that Netanyahu has done with his political supporters from blanket criticism of the state of Israel. They are two different things. Canada is not Mark Carney. Quebec is not François Legault, et cetera, et cetera. There is a lot of opposition to what Netanyahu is doing within Israel, and that needs to be acknowledged. As to the particular statements made by any of these candidates in the past, this is obviously an extremely emotional issue. But it is invariable that if you show up at a protest in which, you know, people are saying, release the hostages, this is terrible, and a bunch of other people are saying, no, the occupation of Palestine is terrible, you guys need to get out, et cetera, et cetera. It's invariable that people are going to, you know, say things in a highly emotional context. It doesn't excuse them, but if I were someone in a position of power within the NDP structure trying to advise the current crop of leadership hopefuls, my encouragement would be not for them to avoid those campus protests, but to try to lead by example at the campus protests and keep things laser focused on criticism of Netanyahu and his supporters, his allies in the Knesset, Ben-Gavir, et cetera, et cetera. Criticize those people specifically.
Taylor, once again, we're going to duly note some stories so people don't miss them. And doesn't seem like there's anything we can do about the reno that's taking place next to you, so listeners will bear with us. What do you have to duly note today?
That Trans Mountain's boss has acknowledged their pipeline capacity has not yet been met, and this essentially means that there's really no need for additional oil pipelines to the Pacific Coast.
What do you make of that?
So this confirms what a lot of analysts have been saying about the prospects of Canada becoming a major oil exporter to emerging markets. It's not going to happen. This idea that Canada is going to start exporting oil and gas to new markets in Asia or to Europe makes no sense, because these places are decarbonizing very, very quickly. And the fact that the head of Trans Mountain is now saying, well, we still have plenty of capacity, that really undercuts any business case for building any kind of new Pacific pipeline capacity in Canada.
Duly noted. I want to duly note this concerning situation in Quebec. People will remember the secularism laws. If you work in the public sector, if you're a teacher, you cannot wear a hijab, you can't wear a yarmulke. Here's the update to that. The protest group Montreal for Palestine has been holding lots and lots of protests in the city. A lot of them have been outside of a church. A lot of them have been outside of the Notre Dame Basilica. Those protests have gone viral this summer, not for anything that has to do with the Middle East, not for any of the signage or the chants. No, it's because some of those protesters take part in Muslim afternoon prayer. Muslims praying outside of a church. This is outraging a lot of people in Quebec. It's the prayer part, not the protest part, that has people so upset. So now Premier François Legault says that he is just going to ban public prayer in the province. And Taylor, I think that what I have to say about this is I'm very concerned, actually, about the free expression implications of banning public prayer. It seems very targeted at Muslims because, like, there's like tons of parades and religious celebrations. I totally accept that there's a feeling of, like, because it's coupled with this protest movement and because of where it's happening at the Basilica, it's feeling like targeted and threatening to people. Or maybe it's just that Muslims pray, and when they're getting together every week, they need to pray. But this is happening, and I think it's heading in a bad way. I think that this is just more social division and, like, really, 2025, we're having, like, religious wars bubbling and heating up in Quebec?
I'm very discouraged by François Legault's ethno-nationalism. As you already mentioned, this is very one-sided. The targets are the Jewish community. The targets are the Muslim community. Essentially, all religious minorities are targeted by these so-called secularism laws. Duly noted.
That is our show for today. Lots of stuff you can email me about. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. Taylor, where can people find you?
You know, I don't want people to find me.
I like that answer. This episode's produced by Jules Bugel. Our associate producer is Lucy Lomonier, who also did the fact check for this episode. Mixing and mastering by Tom Sayers. Our director of audio is Max Collins. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.